Welcome to Shifter's podcast. Today we have one of the most influential thought leaders within the fintech space, author of the best-selling books Digital Bank, Value Web, and now recently Digital Human. He's been an advisor to the White House, the World Bank, and the World Economic Forum, and he blogs at thefinancial.com. And I want to thank Nordic Finance Innovation for the introduction. Welcome, Chris Skinner.
Thank you. Nice to be on Shifter's.
Nice to have you here. So could you tell us shortly about yourself? Who are you and what have you been doing the last few years?
Sure. I mean, I've been working in financial services and technology all my life, mainly for technology companies delivering computers and software to the big banks and insurance companies. And in 2002, I was made redundant, which at the time was a bit of a shock, in that I'm not the youngest of people. But I started doing some hobbies whilst trying to find a proper job, and then my hobbies became my job. And my hobbies are drinking with people. So I run a networking group that networks financial and technology people across Europe, called the Financial Services Club, that actually became Nordic Finance Innovation here in the Nordic region. And then the other thing I do is I talk and think and write a lot about the future of technology and finance and how that's changing society and the world. And as a result of doing that, that's what I do for a living now. I go around speaking around the world at conferences about the future of money and technology.
So how does the future look like for money and technology?
Well, it's changing dramatically, and that's what the three books you referenced, Digital Bank, Digital Human, and Value Web, delved into in depth. And a lot of it's to do with fintech, as we to call it now, but when I was growing up, it was finance and technology, and it still is. It's not changed. You know, banks are actually financial technology companies. They just haven't recognized the technology piece. And about 14 years ago, things dramatically changed because technology became cheap and unlimited through the cloud. And cloud-based services, along with artificial intelligence and big data, have really changed the game, along with mobile networking and apps and open banking and open APIs. And so all of these technologies were emerging in the mid of the last decade. And because the banks didn't recognize the technology piece, an awful lot of the companies that could see a vision of how it could work created startups that became fintech unicorns like Stripe and Klarna. And that's the space I've been working and writing in all my life. But now it's cool.
So how does it look now? So are the banks at another level today than they were 14 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, we've been through what I'd call five cycles of change. We're currently in the fifth, or just about to go into the fifth. The first is the banks really in shock from the financial crisis in 2008, not knowing what to do. And basically, they were like rabbits in the headlights. They did nothing with technology. They were much more concerned about their balance sheets and capital ratios. And it's interesting when you look at a lot of the startups in fintech that they were people who were laid off in 2008. So a good example is the founder of Revolut was working for Lehman's Bank in 2008, which was the one that everyone knows started the crash. So the first cycle was building the opportunity. The second was the fintech startup saying, we're going to destroy the banks. We're going to disrupt. We're going to change you. We're going to attack you. We're going to kill you. And they never did, because banks are quite big beasts that have a lot of protection from regulation and from lack of consumer interest in moving their money to other providers. And so the third wave became the banks saying, you know what, these guys are doing some interesting stuff. Let's invest in them and see if we can work with them. And so there was lots of hackathons and innovation theater and things going on that created banks looking at what fintechs could do, but not really working with them. And then the fourth phase, it was just in the last year, actually, which is much more everyone talking about collaboration, co-creation, partnership, and banks actually nurturing, mentoring, and investing and supporting and integrating fintech into their operations. And then the final phase, which we're just entering, and it may not be the final phase, but I think it leads to a final phase, is when you have what I call a hybrid bank, which is actually a bank that's reinvented itself with technology, working with startups, integrating their capabilities into their operations and giving those services to their customers. It's where a bank becomes what I call a curator of the best-in-class technology providers around the world in finance and deliver that and integrate that seamlessly to their customers.
Interesting. And you talk a lot about banks and startups and within the fintech space. One of the drivers is that, like, you have the big platform companies like Amazon, Google, Facebook, Apple, that are entering this space. And they're not like tiny, small, cute startups that just want to disrupt. They actually can disrupt. Is that one of the main drivers for the banks to really actually get out of the innovation theater and start to collaborate right now?
It's certainly one of the big drivers, in that I often talk about tech fin as well as fintech, and tech fin is the big tech companies getting into financial services, of which everyone talks about GAFA, Google, Amazon, Facebook, Apple, whereas I talk about Fatbag, which is Facebook, Alibaba, Tencent, Baidu, Amazon, and Google. And the reason why the Chinese internet giants are important is that for the last 20 years, I think they've been doing a lot of copyright infringement of US patents, whereas now they've got their own patents and they're leapfrogging America completely, and they're moving to another state where, you know, I'm pretty sure in the next decade, China will dominate most of the technological innovations of the world, and America will be following them, which is a controversial statement, but I believe that's what I'm seeing coming from China. And so when you look at the US, you, because of the financial regulatory structure, wouldn't see PayPal being integrated and merged with Facebook and Amazon, because the laws separate those structures in a way that means they don't come together. I mean, Amazon is moving into financial services, PayPal is moving into financial services, but core deposit taking, full service banking is something that I don't think they want to get into. And the reason is that the payments is the core of commerce. The full service deposit banking is something that's far more regulatory overhead and structured and involves far more boring, you know, capabilities that technology providers don't really want to get into. It's a huge overhead of compliance. And so getting into full bank banking, I don't see that happening with the US giants. But in China, they have moved into full service banking. So Alibaba has My Bank, and Tencent has WeBank. And what's happening in China is interesting, because they now offer, and Alibaba in particular offers through Ant Financial Services, a complete marketplace of plug-and-play software that the big banks in China are taking and using. So the driver is very much technology change, embracing innovation, managing risk. But the biggest divider between an internet giant and a financial giant is the financial giant has to deal with about five times more regulation than an internet giant does. And right now we're seeing that start to change. So Facebook, with what's been going on with Cambridge Analytica and with Instagram, for example, are starting to see the regulators waking up to the fact that social media can create social pressure. And so that will get regulated. But right now they deal with about 20% of the regulations that a bank deals with.
Yeah, so we should not fear, like, if you're a bank, you should probably not fear the American internet giants as much as you should probably fear the Asian ones or the Chinese ones. Is that what you're saying?
I don't think we should fear either. I think we should be watching and looking at what they're doing in depth and trying to see what that means to our own businesses. 20 years ago, everyone was predicting that Microsoft and Virgin would destroy banks. They didn't. And in particular with Google and Facebook, for example, the biggest advertising revenues that they get and therefore the profits that drive their business comes from the financial community. So why would you want to bite the hand that feeds you? You know, Amazon is different. Alibaba is different. And we need to look at those and say, what can we do to emulate those? So for example, I've recently been talking to quite a few banks around digital transformation, what they're doing and how they're doing it. And one of the consistent things is that they're going to the internet giants in Asia and in America, meeting with them, finding out how they run their technology operations, and then trying to replicate and emulate and also integrate and understand how to internalize that capability to their own businesses.
But do you think banks actually are capable of making that transition? Because you have a lot of people that are used to doing banking a certain way, right? And then now there's a totally different way to do it, and it requires maybe some other type of skills.
Yeah.
Are they capable of actually transitioning to that and be a player to be reckoned with? Or would you see both, like some will do it and some won't?
Yeah, I mean, going to where we started talking about the five waves of fintech growth, starting from banks being rabbits in the headlights 10 years ago to some banks being hybrid integrated technology operators, many banks are at one of those five phases. So quite a few are still actually doing nothing with fintech and technology and innovation and digital transformation. In fact, there's probably about 30,000 banks around the world, and I can only name 10 that I think are actually doing digital transformation, which is, you know, a minute number.
And in Norwegian? And in Norwegian of the 10?
Well, I should say the 10 that I could name are the 10 that I think are large, multi-country bank operators are doing digital transformation. There's a lot within countries that are doing interesting things. Like I reference quite a few in my books, mBank in Poland being a prime example. A lot of the banks in Turkey are doing amazing things. Several banks across the Nordic region are doing good things. But when it comes to a large traditional financial provider in a multi-country regional operation doing digital transformation, I can only name a maximum 10.
Okay, and these are 10 good companies that are actually managing the digital transition well, according to you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm working on my new project, which is a book that's going to focus on doing digital and which companies are doing digital well. Because a lot of people say banks are useless, they're stupid, they're not doing innovation, they don't understand technology. And I kind of reject that in terms of I don't think they're stupid. You know, they have good people.
Obviously, yeah.
Yeah. And they have good technology people. I think the problem is that their leadership often lets them down because they don't take digital transformation seriously. They understand compliance, regulation, rules, capital ratios, you name it, but they don't understand digital. And so the five banks that I'm actually interviewing for the new book are ones that actually have leaders who really have understood and internalized digital into their operations and have transformed their operations. And some are well known, like DBS in Singapore or BBVA in Spain. But others, maybe are less known, like China Merchants Bank, and JP Morgan Chase.
Okay. So we're seeing this trend that, you have big or giant technology companies that are entering the fields and wiping out the competition. Right. So, and they tend to be like you, there tend to be a room for the really big ones that can do innovation and digital transformation at scale, and the smaller boutique ones that are providing like special type of treatment for niche audiences. Right. And so my concern is, will there be room for the middle in this space? Like the majority of banks, won't they be either attacked from below or from above?
Well, again, there's always that pressure. And that's always been there for the whole of my career, that the mid-tier banks are too small to be fighting with the big guys, but too big to be fighting with the boutique guys. And they're not very nimble in many cases, but some are, and that's an opportunity. I mean, there's always been a view that consolidation of banks should happen, and it has been happening, but not very quickly. You know, I mean, I said there's about 30,000 banks around the world. Probably 20 years ago, there was 50,000. So 20,000 have been merged or consolidated. There's still a long way to go. And I think we will end up with, a top sort of like the fat bag gaffer acronym that I've given of banks that are global, platforms of financial operations, integrating huge partnerships of many different providers of technology services into those platforms and operations. And then we'll see, as you say, a lot of boutiques. And then we'll have people like Nordea and SEB and others who, I'm not saying are going to be squeezed out, but I think that there will be consolidation over time.
Yeah, so banks can't stand still, even if they're actually making a lot of money today, and there's nothing wrong with their business model today, but they need to be on their toes to be able to transition into the future, right?
Yeah, but that's actually the core issue of banking overall, is that they don't have a burning platform for change.
No. You know,
they get good bonuses. They're making good profits. Their customers don't leave. And all they need to do really is work out how to grow. And normally they grow through acquisitive merger and consolidation. There's not much organic growth in banking. And that is a issue because it means that they can quite easily say, well, I don't need to change my core systems because it's not a burning platform because I'm making good money here. I don't need to invest in new technology and innovation because my competitors aren't doing it and I don't see it being important at this stage. The problem with that attitude is that it will take about 5 years to change the bank at least. And in 5 years, an awful lot can happen. If 10 years ago, the iPhone appeared and people thought it was rubbish because BlackBerry and Nokia thought that, it won't work. It doesn't have a keyboard. They regret that decision. 10 years from now, banks aren't changing fast enough because they don't have a burning platform right now. May find that by the time they get to change, they've been eaten up.
Yeah. I don't know if you know Richard Susskind.
Oh, no, no, no.
Yeah, so he's a law professor, a British one. He wrote the book The End of Lawyers. He said something that I found very funny and interesting. He said that's talking about the law industry. And he said that it's hard to convince a bunch of millionaires in a room that their business model is wrong.
It is. Yeah, absolutely. Right?
Yeah.
But then when those millionaires become sort of, in the job center, they'll realize what the mistake they made. I mean, one of the amazing things right now is, and this is what Digital Human focused upon, is the opportunity for everybody to become an entrepreneur through technology. And my favorite example is Vijay Shekhar Sharma, who's the founder of Paytm in India. And he's now one of India's youngest multi-billionaires. He's worth about $10 billion. But 10 years ago, he was homeless. He'd been bankrupted by what were his friends, he thought. And he actually says himself that he had to take a decision as to whether to go to a job interview on a bus and not have lunch or walk to the job interview and have lunch. Because that's how squeezed he was. He was sofa surfing, and yet he's now a billionaire. So we're seeing a fundamental shift, and the shift is from the industrial era companies that had those billionaires of that era to the new digital era companies that are replacing them. And if you seize that opportunity as an industrial era company or an industrial era bank to become digital, then you can keep up with these changes. If you don't seize it soon enough, then you'll become destitute.
Yeah, so this a lot of people have been saying this the last few years, and you mentioned the term innovation theater. I believe that we still see a lot of that today, and nothing real is happening. And there's something about the mindset. So I just wanted to talk about one thing here that's a little bit local thing here in Norway, but it used to be a local thing in the UK. And we had a big debate on Apple Pay. So I guess you're familiar with Vipps, mm-hmm. which is like the Norwegian Swish or payment system that everyone uses. And they now also own the payment system, the infrastructure, because they've merged. And the owners of Vipps is the majority of the banks in Norway. These owners, these banks, they won't let Apple Pay or the customers use Apple Pay, right? And is that customer centric, or what do you think? You can probably imagine why they're doing it, but does this reveal something about their mindset into like cooperating and going to the future, or is it the smart thing to do?
I mean, certainly I'm familiar with Vipps and what some of the history is here, and I think what was interesting is that because Vipps was around as Apple Pay was emerging before it got here, then you kind of go, why do I need it? Whereas, for example, in the UK, we had a thing called Zap, which no one was using. And so Apple Pay appears, and there wasn't anything else. And so it made sense that people would start using Apple Pay in the UK. I think what's more intriguing for me, and this occurred during one of the Nordic Finance Innovation meetings, NFI meetings, is I spent the time with Alipay and Ant Financial in China, where everything is QR code based payments. And in fact, that's the same technology behind Paytm in India, which is QR code payments. And so as a merchant, I could be a street hawker selling peanuts and newspapers. And all I need is a piece of paper with a QR code on it, and I can take money. That's as simple as it gets. But what's interesting is that they came to Finland with a partner called ePassi. And Epazi presented at our meeting that within 6 months of meeting Alipay, they had it live, up and running, and operational in Lapland for Father Christmas and the Chinese tourists. And then it's a long story, but the long story short is that the next day after that meeting, talking about Alipay and Father Christmas, I had a meeting with Vips, but also with Swish, Sirtu, and MobilePay, which is the other Nordic wallets. And it struck me, it seemed really weird that I can travel 6,000 kilometers from Beijing to Helsinki and use the same mobile app as a Chinese tourist. And I can use that app across all the Nordic region. And yet I can't use Vips in Denmark or Sweden or Finland because there's no interoperability. And so why wouldn't I put a QR code-based payment system and a wallet across the whole of Europe, particularly in the Nordic region, and wipe out Vips? And that question did come up, and now it's interesting because there's now a discussion around interoperability between the four mobile wallets. It still doesn't go back to why won't they let Apple Pay in? And the answer is, do you need Apple Pay if you have these existing services? And is the consumer demanding it? And how much demand is there for it? Because if you look at Australia, for example, Australian banks have resisted Apple Pay coming into the Australian economy, but there wasn't something good enough there before, and so eventually their resistance crumbled.
But should it be up to the bank to decide that? Shouldn't they just give the customer what it wants?
Well, I mean, it should be up to the customer.
Yeah.
And if Norwegians were demanding Apple Pay that much, then I think you'd have Apple Pay, wouldn't
you? So what happened is that Nordea, which is not part of Vipps, and Danske Bank, no, not Danske Bank at first, Nordea, they actually, and S-Banken, which is part of Vipps, they provided Apple Pay possibility for the customers, and they got a lot of new customers going over there. But I'm not saying that that is the rationale for deciding whether to have Apple Pay in your bank or not. But shouldn't you just provide the options that are available for your customers? Isn't that
That's what is the cultural change that banks are finding very difficult to make. So I keep going back to the future bank is this hybrid technology financial structure where the a bank provider is a platform curating a marketplace of partnerships, of services from fintech and big tech that gives consumers choice and corporates. Don't forget the big commercial customers that banks have out there. But the banks to do that have to become a collaborative partnering culture. And right now they're not. They're a control freak. And they have historically controlled everything that the customer gets. And the customer's actually felt that's good because they feel secure. Whereas that's falling apart very quickly, not the secure aspect, that you'd be as secure as ever, but the control freak, non-collaborative, non-partnering structure is gone. That's an industrial era culture. And the regulators are forcing that change with open APIs, PSD2, open banking, and saying, you guys can no longer be control freaks. You've got to open up.
Yeah. To Vipps' defense, they actually made this cooperation with Alipay. Now, if I understand correctly, you were part of that. It's not that like they're not cooperating. I don't want to say that. Let's talk a little bit about open banking and PSD2 and stuff like that. How do you like envision what does the future bank look like for the consumer? What does it look like?
Well, again, it's a controversial debate because a lot of people are saying, oh, bank branches are closing. What's going to happen? What about the old people? Of course, it's always the old people who want to go into a branch and have a chat for the day. Not quite. The banks are reinventing their business models on the fly. And a lot of people make the metaphor comparison to you're in a 747 above Earth, 40,000 feet, and you're changing the engines while in mid-flight. That's what banks are trying to do. They're closing branches and reinventing what the branch exists for, because in a digital structure, why do you need a physical access? Some people do want it. And a lot of the financial practitioners say that people want it for advice. I would challenge that, but I would say it's really for marketing. Because if you can physically see where your money is, even though the money is digital, you feel far more secure than if it's just on a website or an app. And that's the real difference. If there's a physical place you can go and say, give me my money. Yep. Excuse me. Yep. You want to rattle someone's cage, then that's gives you a security blanket you don't have if you purely have an app. The future bank structure, therefore, will say everything is digital. And you start with everything being digital as the core of the bank. You build the bank based on a front office of apps that are connected through the Internet of Things to your devices, not just your phone, with a middle office of APIs, application program interfaces, plug-and-play software that's curated from thousands of partners that provide all the functionality you need to give to those apps in the Internet of Things, with a back office that's all about analytics and all about the data and intelligence about your data and your life, your financial data and your financial life, that provides a contextual personalized service to your apps in that front office Internet of Things. So once you understand it's all about apps, APIs and analytics and building a digital core structure and a platform that's completely open to partnering and no longer being a control freak, you can then say, and at the end of that, what physical access is needed to that digital core structure and why? And you know what people are needed to provide that digital core structure and that personalized interface to your apps? And why do those people need to be there?
So you can actually argue that if you're a boutique hotel, you could actually have like, you could do like a physical thing that where you can meet the, like, if that's brings value to your certain segment of customers, that could be your business, right?
Well, that's what community banks in America are all about. I mean, and that's what they're focusing on in this digital age, where they're saying, we don't really see that we can compete with the big guys, Wells Fargo's and Citibank's. So what we're going to do is we're going to do everything about the local community, the local town where we exist and the services that we give to the town.
Yeah. And that's a perfect, for perfectly viable,
viable. Yeah. Viable, yeah. Yeah. But what they're also doing is they're then saying, but the people in the town also want to have the city and the town and the community-based services online and through their apps, as well as in our stores.
Yeah, so they could actually be a part of this digital structure with a physical outlet, right?
Absolutely.
You're talking about some sort of platform, like a bank being the platform, with the APIs and connecting services to other operators, not only banks, but other players as well. But don't we tend to go towards a platform with network effects? So there will be like one or few big players instead of like having multiple platform, because every bank wants to be the platform, right? Yeah. Or do you envision a scenario where there actually are different platforms? And why would that happen?
The main reason why there may be more platforms than the Google, Amazon, Facebook, Alibaba, Tencent in the tech world. In the financial world, it is different. You know, when you're dealing with money through technology, it's very different than dealing with technology with money. And it may sound like a fine nuance, and it is, but the main difference is that if Facebook sell my data to a partner that I don't have any awareness of, so my privacy is violated, then do I really care? Yeah, I might do, but to be honest, the stuff I put on Facebook, I don't care who sees it. Whereas if they saw my bank balance and could take money out of my bank and take money out of my account, I've got a problem with that. You know, money is far more important than a selfie. So that's the difference. And the difference then comes in saying, what's the security structure around the data that is now money on those platforms? And what will happen is we will see a few platforms that are global, which I referenced, and it may be JP Morgan Chase and Alibaba through Ant Financial. So it may be some of the big tech giants are those platforms. But then the provider of the security to you that's regulated to manage your account to make sure your money is never violated, now your money is data, may still come from Nordea, who may use those platforms. They may use stuff from JP Morgan Chase and from Alipay to make sure you get the best service, but they secure that service.
But isn't this the biggest fear among banks, to become just infrastructure?
To an extent, but you know, infrastructure is important. I mean, if you don't get electricity, then what are you going to do? You know, so it's important. If you don't get financial infrastructure to deliver your services, what are you going to do? It does come down to, did it just become dumb pipes, which is what everyone always says about banks just become these dumb pipe infrastructures in the back end and no one bothers about their brand anymore. But actually, I call them smart pipes, and I think their brand is important. And the reason it's important is going back to, it's my money. It's the second most important thing in my life behind sex. And basically, if it's that important to my life, I want to make sure that it's secure, and that if I want to go and bang on someone's door and say, give me my money, that they are there.
Yeah. It's like Intel Inside, right?
Yeah.
So you have like the brand you have you borrow the trust of the Nordea brand.
Well, I mean, take Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies, Ethereum and everything else that's been going on in the crypto space, and the big boom of 2017 and the big bust of 2018. Where's my Bitcoin gone? There's just a headline yesterday of one of the biggest Canadian exchanges for cryptocurrencies founders has died in India, and he's the only guy who's got the password to access all of the £110 million, £190 million Canadian dollars of funds. So everyone's just lost all their money. If you live in a wild west where something's not regulated, or one guy has the password, that's ridiculous. And that's the problem with money without government, money without security.
Are you invested in a bit in cryptocurrency?
Yeah. But having said that, it's quite funny because I'm with one of the regulated exchanges, and they're so secure that I can't access my accounts. I keep forgetting what the hell the passwords are.
Okay. So one thing I've been thinking about is, can you envision like a future where we have brands that are not banks, right? But you have big brands in all kinds of fields in our society. For example, there's a brand called Patagonia, which is a clothing brand. They're all about saving the future or saving the planet, right? And they have a lot of loyal followers. Could they be like the interface of a bank? Like, because technology is cheap and you have all these service providers, could they put up something together, like create as like a social, what do you call it, conscious type of brand and build a bank behind it because the technology is actually cheap and available?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we end up with is a multi-layered structure of many different services that are integrated into frictionless apps that allow us to live our lives far more easier. And a good example is, you may use Uber or MyTaxi or Airbnb, but none of those would exist without Google Maps and Stripe. You don't know that Google Maps and Stripe are in there. And in fact, most people wouldn't know what the hell Stripe or Klarna was because they're not using Stripe and Klarna. That what they're doing is they're buying something and they see the retailer and their credit card. But behind it are these incredibly powerful services that are big brands, but they're big B2B brands rather than B2C brands. And I think the rise of an awful lot of B2B infrastructure brands is going to be interesting in the next decade because we're going through this digital transformation where most of the brands of the industrial era were visible to consumers because they had big offices and they distributed everything and retailed everything and you could see their names. There's going to be an awful lot of names that no one's going to see anymore except for businesses.
Yeah, and that was actually my point. Isn't it easier for a brand that's not invested in banking today to build a service on top of these API services?
Well, that's what's happening. That's what the fintech unicorns are doing.
Yes, exactly. Isn't that easier than an incumbent bank actually trying to transition into being one of those players?
Well, I think you have both happening because the traditional industrial banks are trying to become innovative digital banks. And very few get it because their leadership are not getting the right internalization of that message. And that's why there's so few that I can name that are really doing it. There's a lot of startups that have become unicorns, like the Monzos and Starlings and the Squares. There's many out there now that are doing amazing things because they've taken a very narrow service and made a very clever piece of technology to deliver that service, such as I keep mentioning Stripe and Klarna because I think they're great examples of a really easy way, frictionless way to build online checkout for a customer without the customer ever knowing who they are. And that's where I think you end up with a bank having to say, why are we doing this development of something that's already out there? For example, Ewan McLeod, who's quite well known from Nordea as their chief digital guy, went through five things that he's learned dealing with fintech. And one of them was that the bank's got to get out of this idea that they have to build everything themselves. So they had a meeting where all the people are saying, oh, Alexa's pretty cool, isn't it? You can just go, hey, Alexa, give me a loan and Amazon will sort you out a loan. We have to do something like this. And so Ewan said, okay, I'll go and talk to Amazon. He said, no, we don't want to talk to Amazon. We need to build Alexa. Well, can't we just use Alexa? No, we have to build our own Alexa. We have to build our own Siri. And that goes back to that control freak culture. You have to get out of that and say, okay, if there's something cool out there, how can we just partner with them, use that, leverage that.
Yeah, probably something to do with the culture of being secure, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
They need to have control of every piece of the puzzle to be able to provide
that's
a secure service.
Open banking PSD2 breaks into to say, you know, your account details are as secure as ever because an awful lot of information and data that's going to third parties is completely anonymized. So it doesn't say who you are and what your account details are. It just says, here's data that customers are, spending. Can you analyze it and do anything with it? I mean, one of the best examples I've seen of that is with BBVA, who have been running an open API challenge for many years. But one year, the winner was a developer who took customer data about spending patterns in real time in Barcelona and Madrid and would advise tourists as to where the best places are to go based on the fact that the point of sales are not as busy as they are in somewhere else. So if you want to go and see the Picasso Museum, it says, well, I wouldn't go right now because 10:30 in the morning, it's really packed. I'd suggest you go to the shopping center, which you mentioned you wanted to visit because it's quite quiet, and go into the Picasso Museum this afternoon.
Yeah, so it makes like an optimal traffic flow.
Yeah, exactly.
For a city. That's interesting. Let's talk a little bit about PSD2, which has been like a major topic and also a trend. I imagine for entire Europe, but we've spoken a lot of it about it in Norway. Does it have the impact that it is intended to have, as you see it?
No.
No. And why not?
I mean, the regulators brought in Payment Services Directive 2nd, which is PSD2. And one of the key parts of that is that banks have to open up payments data to trusted third parties. And a trusted third party has to get a light license to be trusted. But by being trusted, it means that they won't corrupt or sell or hack your data. They're going to use your data to give you better services. And the better services would be that within Facebook Messenger, you could pay your friends. Within any online checkout, you didn't need to give your credit card. You could link it directly into your bank account rather than using a debit card or credit card, and seamlessly and easily. But what happened is that got bastardized by the banks in particular during that process into becoming not seamless and not easy at all. And a lot of that's to do with the fact that to permission a third party to access your bank data, every bank is given a different layer structure of doing that. And therefore customers have to go through quite a rigorous process to make it happen. And again, it goes back to the discussion we're having about, if the customers demanded it and wanted it, why aren't the banks giving it to them? Or equally, if it's good for the customer, why doesn't the bank do that proactively rather than trying to resist it? And it's the control freak, secure nature of banks, going back to what we're discussing in, you know, throughout this discussion. You know, the banks feel accessing customer data will make the customer less secure. So what was interesting is open banking launched a year ago in Britain, which is actually wider than just payments, but it took PSD2 and gold-plated it and made it wider than just your payments. It's your investments, your savings, any data. And the day that was implemented, all the media in Britain said, your banks are about to make it easy to get your money because they're opening up your data to people that you've no idea who they're opening up to. But that was actually what the regulator wanted. So on the one hand, why would a regulator want to make you insecure and less secure with regulation? That's ridiculous. What they're trying to do is to create more competition and more services to customers around their money. And over time, I think it will happen, but it may take PSD 3 or PSD 4 to make it happen. Yeah, but we're already talking about PSD 3 being...
Really?
And as a regulation that will force third parties to give banks data. Because right now, the banks are being forced to give third parties data. Why shouldn't the third parties give banks data back? And then banks could create the services themselves.
That's a good point. It's hard to argue against that, is it? No. Or do you have any arguments against that?
No, because it goes back to right now, and I've actually got the numbers from Bank of America, Merrill Lynch in the US. The average US bank deals with 127,000 regulations. The average US technology company deals with 27,000. You know, and when you're dealing with five times more regulations, it's all about securing your money. You know, it goes back to losing a selfie is not nearly as important as losing 10,000 euro.
So will that ever be simplified, or will the finance sector always be heavily regulated?
Well, it's the friction of moving into the digital century and this digital revolution that we're going to. And it is clearly a revolution. Again, Digital Human talks about that in depth. But there's a really good book that I just picked up, actually, called 100 Year Life. And the average person born in the last decade is going to live for 100 years. Whereas 50 years ago, the average person would live for 65, 70 years. What happens when you've got an extra 35 years of life, an extra third of life? You know, what does that do to savings and retirement and jobs and welfare and structures? And we haven't dealt with these questions yet. You know, and we know there's all sorts of issues bubbling up, like the big pensions hole around the world, because the pensions regulations haven't been refreshed to recognize longevity. And governments and regulators are well behind the mark on digital change, but they're catching up. And it's the same with all the industrial era companies and institutions, whether it be banks, manufacturers, retailers, you name it. They're all being fundamentally challenged by this digital revolution. And the ones who have just started as the babies in the digital age are the ones that we're talking about, the Amazons and the Alibabas, who have taken these opportunities because they were born in the internet.
I want to speak a little bit more about China, because a lot of people fear China. Because China is not known for being the best in class when it concerns human rights, for example.
Mm-hmm. You think America's better?
At the moment, probably not. but still, they're, you know, at least we're in a part of in a NATO with America. There's another type of relation, another type of trust in that relationship, right? Do you think we have something to fear if Chinese financial tech giants are becoming powerful here in Europe?
It's a question that could take up a whole other podcast, to be honest, because we're seeing this superpower shift between US and China. And that's the reason why Trump's created the trade war with China, because they recognize that China's no longer dependent on US for knowledge and business, but they're actually driving the agenda for the future. And equally with 1.4 billion people, they've got a lot more resources than 360 million people in the US. And the US, to me, at the moment, represents what I call the industrial superpower, and China is the digital superpower, and that transition's a tough one. Can US refresh itself to be a digital superpower? Will China, with its human abuse rights records, be viewed that it shouldn't be the next digital superpower, even though it's already pretty much there? I'd say a couple of things. One is that the reason a lot of us don't trust Chinese is that we don't speak Chinese. So we trust our media's reporting of what China's doing, and we're shocked by it because of the way it's reported in our media. Whereas our media, because they speak, most of us, English as a first or second language, trust America because America speaks a version of English as their main language. And so we trust Apple, Amazon, Facebook, and we don't trust Alibaba, Tencent, Baidu. And yet we now know that we can't trust Facebook. And can you really trust US large corporate companies? Can you trust Chinese large corporate companies?
But what's your position on this? Do you trust, to make it very simplistic, do you trust the US and the Chinese is just the same, or do you have any preferences?
I'd say that I'm finding China much more interesting from a future viewpoint than America, mainly because I think China's creating things for the digital age. I mean, a great example is I was in Shenzhen recently with China Merchants Bank. It's the home of Tencent. And when you look at Shenzhen, 40 years ago, it was a fishing village with about 300,000 people, yet today it's got 22 million people, and it's massive skyscrapers everywhere. And I see the same in almost every Chinese city.
But China is not a democracy. Can you trust a non-democracy?
Yeah, but we say we can trust America as a democracy, and yet you see anyone of color being abused in America.
Yeah, but at least you have opposition there. You have people speaking up. You don't have that in China, do you?
I would say there's a lot of suppressed lack of freedom of speech in America. I mean, by way of example, I've worked for American companies most of my life when I had a proper job, and political correctness went mental to the point where you couldn't actually speak freely.
But you have to agree that there's more democracy in the United States than in China, right?
I think that there's more open ability in the US, because it is a democracy, than in China. But I think China's actually...
You can actually say what you want. You're done, you're censored.
Yeah, but you've got to recognize that China's working out a new form of politics that's no longer communism. It's actually capitalism in a communistic form. It's a new form of commerce.
And is that good?
Well, it's a political discussion between what's good, left or right. You take your own decision. I'm in the middle.
Okay, but I mean...
I like the fact that China's moving from being far left to less left. I don't like the fact that America's moving from being right to far right.
But don't you like have a moral preference towards democracy than dictatorship?
Well, I don't agree with dictatorship.
But China's from a form of dictatorship.
No, it isn't.
Okay, so what is it?
It's a form of Chino culture, which is moving towards a less far left communistic capability to become a more capitalistic country. Okay.
So do you envision a society here in the West where you're jailed for your opinions?
Well, that does happen. You know,
but not like in China, is it?
It's not like in China, but there are places, both US and Europe, where if you express certain views, you can get jailed.
Okay.
A guy just got jailed in Dubai for wearing a Qatar t-shirt.
Okay.
And you could say, well, that's Middle East. But, you know.
Yeah, but we're talking about the West versus China. Like, so.
I don't think it is versus. Like, you know, I would like to think that with technology, we will see borders eroded and become global.
I agree with you on the technology part. I agree with you on the progress part of China. They're really making things happen.
And this is going to be a technology debate rather than political debate, because I don't get into politics.
No, sorry. But that's partly because they also have
let's just step back.
Yeah.
If you're looking at the future,
yeah,
you look at the forces of change, which are political, economic, social, and technological.
Yeah.
The political and economic, you can never forecast. No one would have thought Britain would vote for Brexit. No one would have thought America would have voted for Trump. No one would have thought that China would have opened up, you know, 50 years ago. When I was growing up, you know, the idea of being able to go to China with a 2-year multi-visit visa was ridiculous. And Jack Ma never thought that he could break out of China and create a global company. And eventually he did get out of China. And there's a long story behind how that happened. And he invented the idea of Alibaba because he could see what was happening in America. As that goes more global, great. But politically and economically, I have no idea where we're going. Are we globalizing or are we localizing? Yeah, we were globalizing. What's happening today? I have no idea. But from a technological viewpoint, I can always predict the future because technology is fairly intuitively obvious. And all you have to do is watch Star Trek to work out where it's coming from.
Yeah, but Star Trek is pretty optimistic.
It's a utopian vision.
Yes, is it possible to also fare the opposite?
Well, you can Star Wars.
Exactly. And where do you think we're heading?
I'd like to go for Star Trek. It's much more optimistic.
Okay, so do you think that Chinese form of ruling is in line aligned
with I think what's going to happen with China. So for all of its faults, let's go back to what are they trying to achieve, which is global growth, not just within China, but using global resources to help China become a superpower through global growth. If you travel across so many regions, particularly across the African nations, that were underinvested and viewed as just being poor countries by the West, China's invested in those countries. The infrastructure and leapfrogging through technology that you're seeing in Kenya, Nigeria, and in Botswana and Ghana is incredible, and it's Chinese funded. The Belt and Road policy is bringing nations that were languishing with zero investment from the West into the 21st century.
Yeah.
That has to be a good thing.
Yes, you can argue it's a good thing, but the motive is not being a nice country, right? They see an
opportunity. Yeah, like the motive that will all be subservient to the US dollar?
No, but they're seeing a big opportunity in investing in underdeveloped countries. So, but still, I believe it's a good thing. Like the end result, a good thing. It's not necessarily done because you have good intentions, but I believe it's a good thing. But enough politics. the last thing you said you were writing about, you were writing a new book called Doing Digital, and where you have studied the five biggest banks and that are actually doing digital the right way, as you see it. What are the key takeaways you see that they're doing that are right?
There's a number. I mean, I'm. early in the process, but I've already got 15 different key things that these banks are doing that we would all, if we had did these 15 things, we'd be doing digital transformation. I guess I can summarize those 15 things in a few short statements, which is that they are creating fintech banks that think like big tech. So fintech is basically no longer separating the financial operations from the technology operations. They are fully integrated. If you go around the structure of these banks, then they have developers, designers, analysts, coders, all sitting alongside auditors, regulators, and risk people and accounting people. So they don't separate the teams. They're integrated teams that bring tech to the fin and make sure they work together. And then they think like big tech. So they've created microservices structures of small two pizza style teams that can innovate and do things very quickly and turn around things very quickly without having to go through all the caveats and controls of the cascading waterfall monolith structure of old. In particular, they've been driven from a leadership that's gone through the whole organization, walking the walk, not just talking the talk. But that leadership doesn't have the mandate or ability to do that without the CEO and the chair actually being instrumental in making that happen. So every single one, the chairperson has been instrumental in getting the board on board and protecting this transformation process from shareholder scrutiny or critique, because you are going to see a 5 to 10 year program where the banks may be not performing against the same metrics or focus as their peers. You know, shareholder return is not the primary focus. Digital transformation is the primary focus. You have to have the board to protect the CEO and the leadership team to do that. But then the chief executive has to be able to go around their team and change the structure where they need to get it right and make sure that everybody's on board. And one of the big things is that they all bring everybody on board. They don't leave anyone behind. So nearly every bank isn't laying off large volumes of people because they don't get digital, but they're trying to bring them all along in the process. And therefore communication, fast, clear communication is key. They don't have rigorous meetings and structures. They have fast meetings and fast communication. So there's lots of other things and layers in there, but it's quite interesting that all of them are consistent. So of the ones I've met so far, four out of the five, all the messages I've just given are across all of those banks consistently coming through.
Chris Skinner, it has been a true pleasure to talk to you. You're clearly one of the most interesting thought leaders within this fintech space. And I wish you good luck with your new book and your coming book. Thank you very much. And thank you to Nordic Finance Innovation for the introduction. And yeah, good luck.
And happy Chinese New Year.
And happy Chinese New Year.